Hello, and welcome to another edition of the award-winning Sight and Sound Presents. On this edition, we'll talk to Michael McCullough and Bernie Tretta. This is the second and final installment of our interview we did with Michael about his trek to Machu Picchu. Michael is visually impaired, and with the help of Bernie, along with the local team in Peru, helped Michael accomplish his goal. Bernie will also discuss the organization she is a part of, Achilles International. In our first interview, we interviewed Michael and Bernie before their trip. Now, we interview them after achieving their amazing accomplishment. I'm Jim Bratton. Hi, this is Jim Bratton, and this is Sighted to Sound Presents. Today we're talking to Bernie Tretta.
Hi.
And Michael McCullough.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
And with Achilles International, and today one step at a time, right, Michael?
Yeah, that's going to be the title of our documentary that's going to highlight our trek to Machu Picchu.
Wow. We'll get into all that in great detail because I have lots of questions. First of all, I'd like to back into Achilles International. Bernie, bring me up on that, please.
Yeah, so Achilles International is an international nonprofit that helps people with disabilities stay active and participate in sports. And I started the Houston chapter, so Achilles Houston, right, about 7 years ago, which is how I met Michael eventually. But we basically are here to help support anybody with any type of disability, participate in any type of sport, or stay active in any way, or shape, or form that they want to.
On any level.
Any level. Yep. Whether you can only walk 5 feet or you want to be crazy like Michael and climb mountains.
Yeah. Speaking of climbing mountains, first of all, are there any things you want to talk about with Achilles before we drift into this monumental project?
Yeah. We just encourage you, if you have a disability or know someone with a disability or want to volunteer with a group that supports people with disabilities, come out to Achilles Houston, AchillesHouston.org, and join us. We are completely accepting and welcoming of every type of disability, from something like Down syndrome to blindness, amputees, spinal cord injuries, and even schizophrenia.
Wow. Whole spectrum. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, Michael, you're poised. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, something else, Achilles, one of their main things is helping people get involved in also, races and running. I think that's probably one of the main things that first started out doing. But during the summer months, especially here in Houston, and I can let Bernie kind of fill in, some of the other fun activities we try to do whenever it's so hot here in Houston, try to stay indoors or do water activities.
Yeah, we do a lot of, walking, running, wheeling throughout the year every weekend. But in the summer, yeah, it's pretty hot. We want to avoid outside. So we do CrossFit and yoga and kayaking and rock climbing. And just last weekend, Michael jumped out of a plane and the whole group went skydiving together.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I stayed on the ground.
Michael, out of a plane. Yeah, so before we get to the mountain climbing, all right, at least you're touching the earth the whole time that you were mountain climbing. So what was that like?
Oh, the skydiving. So that was the first time. It's a tandem jump.
Right.
So I have an instructor. We're harnessed together. And you spend more time, and there's more, for me, it was more, not fear, but just the anxiety having to fill out all the forms and waivers.
Well, I'll bet so.
you can't imagine how many times the words death and
permanent
disabilities and all kinds of things like that come up, and all the forms that you had to fill out and waivers that we had to fill out it took about almost an hour to fill out all the forms. And then you go through a lot of, little half-hour instruction, ground instruction on everything, and then get fitted into a jumpsuit and learn all the different parts that you need to take care of and while you're in free fall and while the chute's open, that kind of thing. But once we're on the plane, there's no turning back.
Tell me about the free fall. How long did you free fall?
So we kind of... As we get ready, it's your turn to go out. I'm strapped to my instructor, and I had an awesome instructor, Matthew, by the way. We do a crab walk because you're just strapped there and you can't really stand up. So he helps me walk out to the edge, and I could feel my feet, get to the edge and hanging over the side of the doorway there. And I can hear the rush of the wind going by as we're flying. And we're at 14,000 feet.
Okay.
So about 2.6 miles up.
Right, right.
And all of a sudden, you know, we're rocking. We're counting one, two, three. And then he pushes off and we're out there. And it's just immediate rush. Start falling about 120 miles an hour is the speed we're falling at.
Right.
And we're falling all the way down to 6,000 feet. And that's where I'm expected to reach around. And there's like a little golf ball connected to the ripcord to release the chute. But the free fall, what I remember of that, it goes by really quickly. I mean, it's about a little over a minute.
Yeah.
Free fall from 14 to 6,000 feet. And just the wind rushing by. We did have opportunities to do some spins, and those were fun, doing some spins. I happened to had requested to have a video shot while I was doing it, too. So the videographer, he's doing all his maneuvers around shooting us as we're going down. And at times, he would actually come in front of us and, got to do a handshake with the videographer as he got in front of us. And then once we hit 6,000 feet, pulled that ripcord, and just immediately there's an initial jerk back up. And at that point, everything goes from, all that 120-mile-hour wind rushing by my ears to just a so tranquil, peaceful, just start floating. And we floated through. There was that particular day, there were a number of different cloud layers.
Yeah.
And to actually, I've flown through clouds on an airplane, but to fly through one, I could immediately feel the moisture.
I was going to say, could you feel it as you went through the strata?
Yeah, definitely. And the air got cooler.
Yeah,
It went through, and so that was a really nice experience to feel that. And like I said, it's just as we do a number of different S turns and different kinds of turns as we came down to the ground. Obviously, I can't see the ground, but as we got closer, and especially during that tranquil time, I could hear Matthew talking to me, and he would describe the things that were as we were approaching and coming down to the ground. And then as we get closer to the ground, he tells me to lift my legs.
Yeah.
And basically we just come in and on sliding in on our butts, and then quickly just pop right up, and we're down on the ground. But it's really an exhilarating experience. I'd recommend it for anybody that wants to go.
Michael, you've made me silent over here. That's rare. So, wow, I'm just awestruck. The idea of passing through the clouds and feeling the clouds on your face is just... So anyway, okay. Now to the more calm adventure of mountain climbing. So tell us how that came together. And you've got a number of blog posts as you were in preparation. So let's start from the idea of the germination of the whole idea and then walk it forward.
Had been doing mountain climbing, hiking for, since the early 2000s when I first started. And that was about the time I lost vision in my second eye and started having to learn how to do that without sight and using a guide to lead me around and give me instruction. One of the things that was on my list to hike was the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu. And back in 2017, the timing was right. I had just retired and looking around, I was trying to, think of people that might be able to go do and help guide me during the trip. At that point, I was a part of Achilles doing different activities with them. And so Bernie Tredahir, the director of Achilles, I knew that her and her husband were, hikers and also marathoners. And so I knew, there was that would be no problem for them to do the trek and hike. So I approached them. We got together, met, talked about it, and they agreed to guide me. We went and tried to look at different schedules. It turned out from that point on, the next time that was really suitable to both our schedules was not until 2019. I started preparing about a year prior to the trip. The trip we just finished was in June 2019 here. And so back in really May of 2018 was when I first really started training. I did a number of different things, you know, here in Houston, being on flat.
I was just going to say, what are we, 53 feet above sea level or something?
Yeah, barely over sea level, yeah. So, you know, just basic, all I could do was, you know, just basic muscle building, core strengthening kinds of exercises. Did lots of walking, incline treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of the key things that I did was stair climbing.
Right.
And so, you know, my mountain here in Houston was a, I lived right down from a 14-story building.
Right.
And so I would go in there a couple of times a week, gradually building up the number of floors I would climb. And over 6-8 month period, I'd built up to 100 floors and, you know, got to that point just a month prior to our trip. So, you know, I felt pretty strong.
You go back and forth to do 100. You do 100, a cumulative 100
so
floors.
So I would, you know, go up to the 14th floor and usually would, sometimes I would go down the stairs, but trying to keep my heart rate up and cardio going, I would, there was an elevator close by.
Right.
So I'd get on the elevator, get down and try to, you know, start back up again before my heart got too low a level.
Yeah.
So I did that. But then also I have a friend in Colorado, Janice Kopang, who actually became one of my guides also. And so I made several trips out to Colorado, about 4 trips over that year period leading up to the trek, just getting the mountain experience. And, you know, we didn't get to any real high altitude as Machu Picchu would have been. It was at 14,000 feet, but, you know, it was up at 11,500 was the highest I'd gone in Colorado prior to going to the Machu Picchu. So that was the basic training that we had done.
So that was really where I was going to go, was what you do about altitude. I mean, get yourself ready on the stairs and your endurance, but it's a little bit different when you're at 14,000 feet than basically
and
zero
really,
feet.
And really none of us, I mean, other than Janice living there in the mountains, I mean, Bernie and Zach here in Houston, you know, basically you try to go ahead of time, a few days ahead of time, and be there. There's a little town called Cusco.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the trail, and it's at 11,500 feet.
To acclimate there.
To help acclimate, yeah. Okay. So,
Bernie, what were you, all this, he's doing all the training. You're a marathon runner already, right?
Yeah. I didn't actually do any special training.
I was going to say.
Were already out running a lot and, you know, doing marathons pretty regularly, and my husband had done the Boston Marathon right before we went. And so I, like a few weekends I went out and, ran, stairs. I did like 60, 80, and then 100 flights of stairs, three weekends in a row, right about the same time Michael was doing them. And, but that's really, I didn't do anything incredibly different or special because we were already pretty
used there.
To the level of training.
Very impressive. Very impressive to be there with no real training necessary. So that's the physical part of it. Now let's talk about the logistics in preparation for it. It's a major deal. So what did you do in terms of for people who might want to do this on their own?
Mm-hmm.
The preparation, the travel, the logistics, the visa. Tell me.
Well, you, of course, have to have a passport because
right.
It's in Peru. You do not need a visa. As an American, you do not need a visa to go to Peru. And then you do your research and hire a good travel agency. The tour company we used was called Can Do Travel, spelled mm-hmm. with a K, out of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just incredible and just so accommodating and helpful. And they really take care of everything. And so then from there, you know, they tell you when to book your flights and you can, you know, book them longer, shorter, whatever, based on how much time you want to spend acclimating. And they take care of most of it for you.
Yeah, one thing that, if you're thinking about doing this, each day there are only so many people allowed on the trail because otherwise it would just, you know, tear up the trail. So they allow only actually 200 people to actually hike the trail.
Right.
And then there's another 300 that are porters, guides, cooks, and that kind of thing. So a total of 500 people each day
on the trail.
Taking off on the trail. Yeah, the Inca Trail that we went on is a 4-day hike.
Okay.
And so you have to get those permits early on. Usually they start handing out the permits in October for the coming year.
Wow.
And so it turned out our photographer who was going with us was having some issues with his passport, because you have to send in a copy of your passport in order to get the permit also. And it wasn't until December until we were actually able to get the permits. And so the original date we were wanting to go was in May. And so that kicked, or actually end of April. And then all the permits had gone by the time we were ready to apply for them. And so we ended up pushing off until June, which was actually, it turned out to be a really nice time of the year to go. Actually, you know, the little town of Cusco that I mentioned, where you stay before you take off on the hike, the month, whole month of June is kind of their winter solstice celebration. Every day there's some festivals going on.
So you arrived there for an ongoing festival.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Perfect timing. We didn't even know it.
So you pack your day pack?
Yep.
Full of whatever you want to take and make all the arrangements. Okay, so here we are. We're to the, you've got your, what, day or so of acclimation that you're doing there, acclimatization, and you're about ready to get on the trail. So then give me a picture of what all happens. Is this whole thing going? This sounds like quite a project.
Yeah. So it was the people involved were Michael, of course.
Right.
And then myself, my husband, and Janice as the three guides.
Right.
And then we had Robert, who is a videographer, because Michael's making a documentary of
right,
this.
Right, right.
And then Juan Carlos was our tour guide, our trail guide.
Right, right.
And then we had a whole harangue of porters. I mean,
yeah, there were, what, 13 total porters, cooks, and then Juan Carlos, the trail guide, and then the assistant trail guide.
Yeah, yeah. So we load up in two giant vans and all drive together to the start of the trail. And it was a whole bunch of us and a lot of bags.
So this is not a backpack with a trail tarp in it, then.
No. Yeah, we were incredibly impressed. We've done backpacking before, and you know, you have like oatmeal for breakfast, trail mix for lunch, and ramen noodles for dinner. And this was a full spread of food for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, including an appetizer, an entree, and dessert, and snacks, and tea time. It was incredible. Like, I've never eaten so well in my life on the trail. I didn't expect to eat that well, like, on a regular day, let alone on the trail. Yeah, I actually might have put on weight during this hike.
That is incredible. Now, so it sounds very luxurious, but it's a difficult trail, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're doing some serious walking during this.
Yeah.
Take me through the days. What happens on a typical day after your gourmet breakfast, of course?
Okay. So the first day is kind of the easy day, kind of a warm-up time. We start out, like I said, about 11,000 feet. And actually, the final campsite we reach, we go down to about 9,500 feet.
Okay.
And there's some ups and downs, and there's not a lot of steps involved like we get into on the third days, fourth day. But it's a good warm-up period. We did that in, I think, about 7 hours, something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then we, camped out overnight. It was fairly warm that first night.
Right.
We were at a fairly low altitude.
So, warm being 40.
Yeah, so you got to remember.
It's all relative.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you got to remember June in South America is on the southern hemisphere,
exactly.
So it's winter down there, right?
So I was bundled up, and everybody made fun of me because I never shed my hat and coat and gloves.
Sure.
Yeah, it's winter down there, and of course, being at altitude, you're going to get, it's going to get down, and actually there were a couple of days where it's, below freezing there overnight camping out.
Really?
The second day, we start hiking up, and this is the highest we're going to go, just under 14,000 feet. And
so from 9,500 to 14,000, yeah, that's in
one day.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, you actually go up over the summit and then back down about halfway down that again, back down to roughly 12,000 feet, I think. But, that pass, affectionately known as Dead Woman's Pass.
Not because people die.
No. Yeah. Well, that's good to know.
No dead women on the pass. It just looks like one.
Yeah, the shape of the mountain formation, it looks like a lady laying down. But it's fun to talk about. But I guess need to back up a little bit. Found out like 2 weeks prior to us taking off, I had been having some knee pain 6-8 months on, and I'd been getting some steroid shots, and that usually relieved it. But I went ahead and got an MRI, and I was actually in Colorado doing my last mountain hiking training. And then my doctor calls me and says, the MRI shows that you've torn your right meniscus all the way through now, and that you have very little cartilage under your kneecap. And also, I'd done a MRI on my back. I'd been having sciatica, and said I had a herniated disc at L4, L5 that was causing the pain there in the through my right leg. So, you know, both legs having some pain. But so I got back, got some second opinions, and basically my orthopedic surgeon said, you know, you can't do any more damage to it than it is. We can, you know, tape it up and give you some special braces to put on and give you some pain meds. And which that was probably a big mistake for me anyway. The one of the pain meds he subscribed I'd never taken before.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was a reaction to, you know, other meds I was taking or in combination with the altitude.
Altitude could have had a whole lot to do with it.
So I started taking it on that second day as we were ascending.
So you took, so you took a pain med you're unfamiliar with.
Right.
On the second
at
day.
At altitude.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said. I'm not meaning to laugh, but
it's kind of comical because you know we tried out our shoes and our sunblock and things in advance.
Well, yeah, you're doing 2,000 steps a day.
Yeah,
office building.
And he's just like, "Oh, I'll try this new pill out. What's the worst thing that can happen?"
So I was, you know, starting to get pretty loopy as we were ascending and reaching the summit there. And
additionally, we're almost at 14,000 feet, and he's taking an opioid which slows your breathing. And so he was, you know, hallucinating.
Oh, no, I mean, you could do that on, I mean, I've done that on my own at altitude, without anything, so yeah.
I was huffing and puffing as we reached the summit there. I actually had to get on some take some oxygen for, you know,
Porters have that handy.
They carried an oxygen tank.
Yeah, just in case. And so, you know, I did that for 20, 30 minutes, and I was fine after that. But the main issue was on the descent. I would go down a little ways, and then just the pain, the combination of the pain in the knees plus the wooziness, they were too afraid that I was just going to fall and couldn't follow. Mm-hmm. Plus, we were going very slow.
Yeah.
And so the porters, that first day, actually tried to make like a little carrier.
Oh, is it an armchair or something?
Yeah, well, they strapped together some backpacks and with straps, and then had two porters holding it on either side, and I was sitting in it and tried to do that for a couple of hours, and that was just too heavy. So,
well, yeah, they brought them down. So when we crested the mountain, it was about 2 p.m, and you could see the storm clouds rolling in. And Juan Carlos was very concerned because the trail is very treacherous. And so we had to be in camp by sunset.
Right. And you have fixed camps that are stop points along the way. You can't just pitch a tent someplace.
Exactly. And and there's really no places to pitch them. I mean, sometimes the trail is only 3 feet wide.
Absolutely.
And so, you have to make it to camp. There's no in between.
Right, right.
And so, you know, he was getting very concerned that we need to be moving a lot faster than we were. And so, there really wasn't any option. So they just picked Michael up and carried him, and we got to camp about 10 minutes after sunset, and they were moving. The porters were carrying Michael and moving so fast. They were nearly running, and we could not keep up. And we were moving as fast as we could, and we were all, like, Janice is a expert mountain climber living in Colorado, and Zach and I are in great shape too, and we could not keep up with the porters running while carrying Michael. And down some incredibly steep and scary and treacherous declines and stairs. And so there's no way. We probably would have gotten in past midnight at the pace that we were moving. So they carried him probably 4 hours down that trail.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And their conditioning is natural conditioning.
Oh, they run up and down it every single day.
Because they do it all the time. Yeah. They don't have to prep for anything. Right. They just do it.
Yeah, some of them are in like flip-flops or terrible shoes.
I was just
going to
say, right.
And, you know, carrying at least 40 pounds on their back. And sometimes it's just like a tarp that's rolled up with tied together with ropes. And then they tie that rope around their chest. I mean, they're not like fancy $300 backpacks like all the Americans
Gregory
are carrying.
Or
right. Yeah.
It's pretty amazing what they can do.
But the crux of it is you made it. God, I'm just. What could go wrong?
So that was the second.
Only day two.
Yeah, that was the second day. The third day is actually the longest day.
Yeah,
you don't go quite as high. You go up. The next little summit we had to go over was about 13.3, I think.
Yeah,
and so we, but again, we're going. I could make all the ascents. I was okay going up,
right?
Like I said, coming down, and this time rather than using the little carrier, just had two porters on either side, and I was just holding my arms over their shoulders as we went down, and we were able to get down okay like that, and got back. It was after dark that day. It was about a 13-hour hike.
Yeah.
So we're on day three now.
Day three.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Another day to go.
Yeah.
So we survived that. Like Bernie said. There was, because of my wooziness, and I love the food that we had. That was a special time. But as soon as the meal was over, pretty much everybody, as soon as you made it into your tent, you were just kind of dead, and slept until
they rolled out a tarp for Michael, like at lunchtime. So they basically rolled out a tarp at the camp that we would go to lunch, and then they just set Michael down, and he slept through lunch, maybe had a little bite of food, and then pick him back up. And then the same when we got into camp at dinner time, they rolled out a tarp, Michael slept until dinner was ready, and then went to bed right after.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I was taking advantage of any rest periods I could get. Yeah.
He would even nap on the trail. Like, they'd sat down, and he could fall asleep for like a 2-minute nap. It's incredible.
There's an art to that.
Yeah.
It helps me if you nudge it along the pharmaceuticals, I guess.
Yeah, the medication definitely played a role there.
So let's get to the end of the trail then. Mm-hmm. What happens then?
So, okay. We get to that last day, there was one little comical thing.
The toilet incident.
I don't remember exactly everything that happened, but
and all of us will never forget it. Michael can't remember it. We can't.
I'm sure he can't. You won't.
The first day they had placed the toilet tent kind of close to where we were,
right
to our sleeping tents, and so. The subsequent days, they tried to kind of move it a little bit further away, and the placement of it on, was it the third day? Third day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was on a slight incline. And so I needed to go use the facilities, and, someone guided me down in there, and I got situated and sat down, and I felt it. I felt like I was rocking a little bit and starting to tilt, and so I grabbed the tent pole, and then all of a sudden, the next thing I know, everything is falling over. I had enough, wherewithal, at least as I was falling, I kept the bucket toilet sitting upright as I fell.
And so here's what we all hear and see. We are all sitting in the food tent having tea and popcorn.
This is very elegant. It's very elegant trail meal.
And the toilet is probably 15 feet away, maybe 20 feet away. And we know Robert has walked Michael down to use the toilet. And I think he said, don't bother waiting. And we're pretty sure Michael fell asleep. He says he was awake, but every time he sat down for more than two minutes, he'd fall asleep. So all of a sudden, we hear a yell coming from the toilet and a yell coming from the porter that's in charge of the toilet, just in time to see Michael fall out of the tent and the tent collapse around him. And the porter is screaming and yelling, and Juan Carlos was up in a flash. And he covered those 15 feet in a split second. to make sure Michael was okay, and then couldn't control himself with laughing. And then Michael hadn't finished up, so Juan Carlos had to hold his hands, so because the tent was all collapsed, and had to hold Michael's hand to help him.
That's the first time I've ever had to do my business holding hands with another guy there.
I would, you know, Michael, I would claim to not remember that as well, I think.
Well, and then in the middle of the night, he had to get up and use the restroom, and it's pitch silent out there. It's totally, totally silent and dark. And you hear the tent, like, unzipping.
Oh, yeah, no, I know the sound.
And Michael starts to walk out, and somebody yells, "Don't break the toilet!" And then in the middle of the night, we're all cackling, all the porters, all the hikers.
So, and your videographer is along on this whole thing, right?
Yeah. Okay. First thing he does is goes and grabs his video camera.
I am sure he did, first thing first.
And so Juan Carlos has been hiking these trails for 16 years, and he says, there were a lot of firsts. I've never hiked with a blind man. I've never had to do a mountain... We've had very few mountain rescues. He's like, but this is the first time anybody's fallen off the toilet or broken the toilet tent.
Let's see if we can get... Okay, that is right. An incident we did not want to omit from this narrative by any means. So, after you re-erected the outhouse and I guess struck it for the next day,
yes,
and you're on the trail again, and I assume you've adjusted to the narcotics at that stage to some degree.
To a certain degree.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what happened...
I stole his pills.
Bernie took all my pain meds away.
Yeah.
They would only give me one a day instead of the three or four I was supposed to take.
I was babysitter, and there's a great video of me snatching it from him. Like, no more!
Daily.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, Bernie, why don't you go ahead and tell them what happened on our fourth day hiking up to the Sun Gate?
Yeah, day four is another easy day. So day one and day four were easy, where two and three were very long and hard.
Right.
And day four, for the average hiker, it's about an hour. You have to pass through the checkpoint that, you know, they stamp your passes. And then it's about an hour from there to the Sun Gate, which is the perch overlooking Machu Picchu.
Yeah.
And then another hour from the Sun Gate down. That's for the average hiker. We took about 3 hours to the Sun Gate and another 3 hours down to Machu Picchu. So it was about a 6-hour hike that day. And it was beautiful. By this point, you've come down the mountain, and you're at a much lower altitude. And
right.
So you're actually in a rainforest. And so there's wild orchids and bromeliads and just an incredible amount of wildlife and plant life everywhere. It was stunning. But the trail was incredibly treacherous again. So just sheer cliffs, very, very narrow. There were a lot of areas where, because of the amount of rain and moisture, the trail could easily become dilapidated. So they do a lot of construction on it. But the trail, again, was less than 3 feet wide in many, many places.
Wow.
So we were moving at a pretty good clip for Michael. It was a nice trail until we got to the Sun Gate. There was one spot called, they call it the Gringo Stairs or the Monkey, the Gringo Killers or the Monkey Stairs, which are... I think it's 42 steps that you can basically, they're so narrow, you can only get your tippy toes on.
Oh, my.
And you have to go hand over fist. They're greater than a 45-degree angle up. And so...
So it's like bouldering almost.
Yes, absolutely. And it's quite treacherous. And so when Michael went up, he had his backpack on and they tied ropes to his shoulders so that and Juan Carlos went up ahead of him
so that
as Michael climbed, if he started to fall, Juan Carlos could pull. And even when we were going down, he would do that where it was tied to his back and Juan Carlos was behind him then so that if Michael started to fall forward, Juan Carlos could pull him back and steady him. But so it was really, really scary because he couldn't have any help because the stairs were so tiny and narrow and almost impossible to do without using your hands.
Was this developed as a trade or a religious trail or a spiritual trail?
Many, many trails. So even though this one is called the Inca Trail, there's hundreds of trails throughout the area.
Right.
But this was the trail that royalty used.
Yeah.
So there was a military trail, a royalty trail, a trade and peasant trail, all leading to different places. But Machu Picchu itself was a kind of scientific observatory point for so all of the scientists and some royalty lived there, so that's why the trail went there.
Wow, and so it was one of the better developed of the
Yes.
Of the trails, and cumulatively then.
Yes, but they go all the way into Colombia even.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But okay. lots of steps, yeah.
Yeah. So then after we made it to the Sun Gate, it was kind of a weird experience because, you know, we're the only people on the trail. It's quiet and peaceful and just literally the guides and Michael and a few porters. And then we get to the Sun Gate and there's, you know, hundreds of people there and they've taken the train up and then hiked and they're in flip-flops and taking selfies. And, you know, we smell and have been sleeping on the ground and have these huge backpacks. And so it was just kind of a weird experience to run into them. But the view was incredible. And you get to see, you know, the iconic Machu Picchu down below you. Yeah. And then it was another 3 hours or so hike until we got to Machu Picchu. And it was worth every step.
Yeah. Wow. And then, okay, so you get, and then, what about the return then? So you're there?
Oh, we took the train.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. I didn't think you'd walk back down.
No. I mean, it's like off the trail and suddenly you're at a Buc-ee's or something. Right?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, once you reach Machu Picchu, I mean, that is the reward itself. And spend a little time there going around looking at the different, you know, historic sites and the ruins and things like that. And then take the train back later in the afternoon.
This has been a delightful conversation to have. I remember as we talked about the preparation for it, and it's so great to hear the way it came to fruition. And thank you for sharing some of the more comical moments, even though they might be a little bit self-embarrassing.
One thing I just want to add on, you know, we've been talking about our photographer. What we're doing there is creating a documentary that's going to chronicle all of this, and you know, we're still looking. Anybody that wants to help out with the documentary, sponsor that, can always go to AchillesHouston.org, and there's a donate button there, and then you'll see a button to donate to the documentary.
So to learn any more about this and other activities, it's AchillesHouston.org is a good contact point. Is that the best contact point for all this?
Or Facebook and Instagram. Okay. Pretty easy to find.
Yeah, just key in any of that in your main search engine, and it'll take you to some options. And I guess has been a delight. Anything else that you want to add before we wrap things up today? Any other embarrassing moments, Michael?
Well, after I got back from the trek, I had to take care of my knee, so I had some knee surgery to repair the meniscus and clean up around the kneecap, and so I'm recovering from that now. I'm about 6 weeks out since the surgery. It's coming along good with the rehab, and I'm trying to get in shape. The doctor says about 3.5 months of rehab, I should be back to, you know, back to where I was before the surgery and should be feeling good. So I've got I'm also coordinating, there's a group called Ski for Light. It's a group that holds an annual event for blind and mobility impaired people. And each year, go to different places around the U.S. to do cross-country skiing. Okay. So I'm the coordinator of our Texas team, and so we're right now getting people lined up, applying for the trip there. And so in next February of 2020, we'll be doing a trip to Casper, Wyoming.
And so where would you go to find that information then?
Okay, so the Ski for Light website, sfl.org.
Okay.
Makes it easy, yeah.
It has been just a delight to have both of you on. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
That is Bernie and Michael, a pleasure to have you. And this is Sight into Sound Presents. I'm Jim Bratton. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Sight into Sound Presents. Thank you to Michael and Bernie for sharing their story on their successful journey. For more information about Achilles International, please call 212-354-0300. That's 212-354-0300. Sight into Sound Presents is a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas. Your producer was Jim Martinez. I'm Jim Bratton.